day here grinding through camp, you know, try to build off what we did yesterday and, you know, move into some situational stuff for Carolina, where we'd normally be from a kind of regular season work week, kind of. But, you know, we still work on a lot of things that we just need to work on. So, just grinding it up.
Jonas Gray is a guy who's been in the league a little bit but hasn't played much. I'm just curious what you've seen from him.
Hardworking kid. Really, you know, worked hard in the offseason, worked hard in the spring, worked hard in training camp, been out there every day, making progress, improving.
See how it goes.
But he's done everything we've asked him to do.
How have you seen the progression between Tom and Brandon LaFell as camp has gone on?
Again, both players have been out there. They've been able to work together on a daily basis. And I think that it continues to improve. Again, I think we have a long way to go, but definitely making progress, heading in the right direction. I think probably each player is kind of getting used to the other one a little bit. But that's normal.
What do you like about Brandon? I mean, what have you gotten to learn about him over the last 5 months or whatever?
You know, he's been good. He's been very diligent in trying to, you know, learn his assignments, learn the plays. I mean, he's a tough kid. He's played for us in the kicking game. He's given us some plays there, which, you know, at that position, it's always good to get those out of those receivers. I mean, it's kind of like bonus plays. But I think he's been, you know, very competitive. He's obviously a big target. And, you know, he's gotten better at the routes that we've run. I thought the deep out route that he ran in the game was good. It created a lot of separation on that. So, you know, he's got a good skill set, a little different than some of our other guys, but good, and he's tough.
Is it more difficult to get a bigger wide receiver or maybe a lankier wide receiver integrated into special teams than maybe a shorter, quicker guy?
No, it's probably the bigger guy might have an advantage. Other than in the return game, although Brandon's worked for us on kickoff returns as well. No, I think size, you know, size and strength are big attributes that you got to have to block or take on blockers unless it's a return guy. I think those are things that kind of work in his favor, and he did him in Carolina. But he's, you know, he's tough and he's competitive, and he does a good job there, so. Just another way that he can contribute to the team, and I think that's really been one of the best things about Brandon. It's just, you know, he's finding different ways to contribute, whether it's blocking, receiving, special teams. He's done whatever we've asked him to do. He's done it well. He's gotten better at it, and you know, I think he'll be able to carve out a role for himself here. Might be a big one. I don't know. We'll see.
Consideration when you start looking at the position groups towards cut down day is to, okay, this guy also plays on two of these special teams and this one doesn't play on any. And I'm really looking at the wide receiver group. In essence, Danny can return and Julian obviously returns. LaFell has some. Kimbrell, I'm not sure if he does any stuff. Does it all weigh in?
For sure it does. And especially in the positions where you normally don't get. I mean, you see returners come from the wide receiver group. That's, I'd say, where most of them come from. Not all, but most of them come from. But when you get contributions from those guys in coverage, or you take an offensive or a defensive lineman that generally doesn't have much of a role in the kicking game other than field goal, and they can contribute for you on a team or two, then that's just, you know, bonus that you don't normally get. So, sure, everything counts. You bet.
Looking for a kick returner, obviously, other than the physical stuff. What are some things that make a good kick returner? I imagine vision is one of the first things that kind of pops up.
Are you talking about kickoffs or punts?
Or kick return.
Definitely vision's important. You know, speed's important because the faster you can, you know, get the ball from the goal line or wherever it comes down, you know, up into that 15, 20-yard line area, then the more you can avoid that outside guy, whoever it is, and you can't, you know, really block everybody Well, you can, but once you start double-teaming to create running lanes, then you run out of blockers and you try to let somebody go, usually the backside guy, the guy furthest away from the ball type of thing. And so fast guys can get past them before they're able to, you know, come down and make the play. So speed, and then either some combination of quickness and power to break tackles. You know, somehow or other, returners to be good have to be able to make some yards on their own. They have to be able to either avoid them or be strong and run through them, as well as have good vision and find the holes. So it's, you know, kickoff returns are a little different than punt returns because, you know, you have so many guys coming down at the same time and you have a chance to generally build some momentum, build some speed and read on the run, whereas a lot of times on punt returns, they're right there on top of you. You got to make a quick decision. There's only two guys down there, so usually the gunners. Unless the ball has a lot of hang time, but there's usually that first wave of just two guys and then, or however many of them get down there, and then you have kind of that second wave, so the ball handling is quite a bit different, I'd say harder on punts, and certainly the decision making, we know once you get into plus 50 punting and things like that are a little bit different other than making the come out of the end zone or not come out of the end zone on kick return, so there's not a lot of guys in the league to do both. There certainly are some, but then there are quite a few guys that do one or the other because the skills really are a little bit different.
Bill, on that note, in preseason games, kick returner maybe getting an opportunity that he might otherwise not get. Do you want him to stick to the rules that you would have during the regular season, or because hey, it's an opportunity to return a kick, just go do it and show us what you got?
Yeah, I'd say generally speaking, you want to try to return, you know, when you can, but at the same time, we don't want to, you know, coach bad decision-making or coach bad fundamentals, so. But, you know, generally speaking, we tell them if it's in the gray area, let's go with it.
Well, how important are these preseason games for the defensive backs? Obviously, with points of emphasis being in the secondary now and illegal contact, are these preseason games more important than normal because defensive backs are kind of, and the coaching staff getting a feel for what's allowed and what's not allowed?
Yeah, I mean, probably pretty important for everybody, though. I mean, like there's probably as many offensive holding, hands to the face, defensive hands to the face. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen them make of those called either. So, it's, you know, it's like it's for everybody. Linebackers, illegal contacts on the tight ends and rerouting receivers and so forth. It's really, I think it has application to you know, all the defensive skill players and the offensive and defensive linemen with all the, you know, the holding hand to the face, roll blocks. And, I mean, you know, it's, again, there's no new rules, but certainly been a lot of calls in those areas.
Devin told us that it's a little bit different for the safety as opposed to the cornerback right on the line of scrimmage.
Sure.
In what you've seen in the film, what is the big difference between that rule as it applies to corners off the line of scrimmage and a safety?
Well, they're usually not as close to the receivers. I mean, it could be in man coverage, but if it's not man coverage or for Devin, where he's playing a lot of deep field coverage, he's, you know, usually not that close to the receivers. You know, they're already into their route. He's breaking on the ball, and you know, he's usually covering more of an area. But even when they're in man coverage, a lot of times that's from depth as opposed to right on the line. So they know they can't contact the guy after he goes 5 yards, and most of the time they're not really, you know, in that break point area until that 8 to 12 yard range. So it really doesn't come up unless the receiver runs close to the defender, runs right into him, then you have it. But yeah, it's definitely less frequent.
On the kickoff returns, back to that for a second, is it common to break down the film and see a guy who just took the touchback and you notice maybe there was a mistake, there was an opportunity that maybe he didn't see? I mean, is that common to see that nowadays? Even with the increase in touchbacks, I would believe.
Well, again, you know, when the kickoff return is back there catching the ball, I mean, the three things that affect him the most are the depth of the kick, the hang time of the kick, and the posture that he's in when he catches it. So no matter how deep you are, if you're kind of waiting for the ball and going forward and rolling into the catch is a lot different than if you're backing up or going sideways or that type of thing, because just the momentum and the start of it is a lot different. You know, you hear people refer to a depth in the end zone, but I mean, I don't really think that is the final story, because if a ball with no hang time deep in the end zone is a lot more favorable to return than a ball that's not as deep in the end zone with quite a bit of hang time. So, you know, there's the combination of that. So it's a judgment, but all that is going on. Really, the returner doesn't see the blocking pattern develop until he's probably about on the 10 or 15 yard line. Usually, you know, some of those blocks are set early, but a lot of them don't take place. I mean, you have your front line blocks, but then the rest of those blocks don't take place until, you know, the coverage team is inside the 30 for sure. So, you know, by the time he gets the ball and brings it out and then those blocks take place, that's when the lanes, let's say, do or don't open up. So it'd be pretty hard for him to, you know, catch the ball and feel like, oh, my God, I missed a big hole there, because it's just kind of too early to see it.
What are your thoughts on the practice squad teams potentially expanding to 10 members?
Whatever the rules are, we'll
work with them.
When you are making decisions as to who may or may not make that practice squad in the end, of, you know, from the players that are available to you, is it it may differ from case to case, but do you look at the roster that you have and say, we could use a little more depth here and it would be helpful to have a guy at this position, or do you look at just the overall potential of an individual player?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, but it's really both. I think you've got to have enough players to practice. So sometimes if you go shorter in a position on your 53-man roster, you can subsidize that with a player or two on the practice squad, so it doesn't, you know, screw your practices up, and you're able to, you know, maintain a normal flow of practice. So, I mean, you know, you got to have receivers to run patterns, you got to have linemen to block, you got to have DBs to cover. I mean, you know, somewhere along the line, you need all those things. So, if you're short, then balancing out the roster with numbers is, that's certainly part of it. But at the same time, the players you want on the practice squad, you would like for them to be guys that you think could develop and eventually become roster players. So you don't really want to let – if you feel that way about a player, you really don't want to let him go for a player who you don't think is a roster player, even though he plays the position that you kind of need, if you will. So it's a balance. And it's similar to when you pick out your 53-man roster. You know, there's times where you – end up taking a player, keeping him on your roster because of the position he plays. There may be a better player at a different position, but you have more depth there, and you just can't afford that extra guy. You just need whatever it is that you need. And then I'd say the practice squad then is just, you know, a residual of that. Hopefully you can balance it out, but usually it doesn't work out quite that way. You usually have some of the same situations on the practice squad. Yeah, you have a couple guys at the position you need, but then, you know, here's somebody else that you think has more potential as a player, but you really need something else to kind of help you practice. And so, and you see a lot of juggling of the practice squads, you know, throughout the first 6 weeks, half of the season. And that's part of it, is you get injuries or your roster changes a little bit, and then you need players on your practice squad to fill in those gaps. Or you find somebody that you like and think, you know, this guy has a chance to develop. You want him on your practice squad. You're willing to, you know, take one of those spots, even if it's at a position of depth, to work with that player because you think you like him. So, you know, we have a number of players on our team that have been on the practice squad. And then I would also say there are a number of players on most teams on the 53-man roster that don't play, that effectively are on the practice squad, but they count on the roster so you don't expose them to the rest of the league. So, you know, if a guy doesn't play and he's on the 53-man roster, or if he doesn't play on the practice squad, it's kind of the same to the team, except one player is protected and one player isn't. It's different for the player because the compensation is different, but it's in terms of managing the team, there's certainly some interplay between those two situations. But it's an interesting, you know, like that's part of the, you know, part of the things that we're talking about or going to have to talk about soon is not only your 53-man roster, but your practice squad, who you think you get to your practice squad, who you think you couldn't, and who, you know, what do you need from a practice standpoint, but then the quality of the player or potential quality of the player, how does that play into, you know, which guys you keep? So it's an interesting, lengthy discussions.
Would it be fair to logically follow then that, at least for the teams, the guys who would have otherwise been released and not able to be brought back to the practice squad, you'll have two more spots for guys who might be projects for down the line you've already invested a lot of time in?
Well, I think the reality of it is that those are probably the players that are going to get signed in the first few weeks of the season when teams have needs at that position, that they would, you know, that if they're not with any team and they're available, then those are the kind of guys that you would go out and add on to your team. And some of them, now there's some older veterans that you would do that with too, but certainly those, you know, first, second year guys that maybe made the team last year, but so their practice squad eligibility is up, and then this year they don't make the team or a team, and then you get into the season, 3-4 weeks into the season, and instead of going with a rookie, you look at a player like that and say, well, you know, here's what he did last year. He's got, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 games of experience, whatever it is, didn't quite make the roster. You know, that guy might be the guy over the rookie, might be the guy over the rookie on your practice squad too. So I think keeping those guys in the system, it's probably a lot of the same guys who are going to be signed. So, and the only reason they weren't on the practice squad last year is because they weren't eligible, not because they weren't wanted, but they just, by rule, you couldn't do it. So I would imagine a lot of those guys will show up there.
Good year after a bad camp. What would be some of the red flags or the positive signs that signal to you, big picture, you're having a good camp or a bad camp?
I think it's, you know, probably just an overall feeling. Just the way that the team works, the way it responds to the things that they're asked to do in camp, and how they, you know, how they handle some of the tests that they're put through, because it's a grind. It's tough. I mean, it's a competitive, very competitive situation, and you know, it's a challenge, you know, for the team, not just the players, but you know, the entire organization, to handle all the things you have to handle in training camp, and you know, without something kind of internally being a problem, and then, you know, being ready to go. So I think to be able to, you know, show some mental toughness, some ability to block out distractions and focus on your job and improve individually and as a team and all those things. If you can do those over a training camp period of, you know, call it 6 weeks, then it's probably a pretty good indication that you would have a chance to do it during the year. And if you can't, then it's probably an indication that when the pressure really comes on during the season, which the pressure is going to mount for the team as the season goes, let's say the likelihood of it all like just magically coming together without much of a foundation, or I haven't had a lot of great experience with that, so we'll see. Okay, thank you.